till everyone else is done.
All right, we're going to call the Transportation and Public Safety Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, January 26th. Today, members, we're going to have two more overviews, one on Minnesota aeronautics and aviation, and the other on Minnesota's ports. Hoping that Senator Reinert will be here soon. Oh, it looks like he might be already here. Great. Awesome. And with that, let me invite Cassandra Isaacson, Tom Warner, and Michael Lawrence forward. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed as you see fit.
Sure. My name is Cassandra Isaacson. I'm the Director of Aeronautics for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And I have a few slides here that I would go through to kind of give you an overview of aviation in Minnesota and MnDOT's role in that. I'd be happy to answer questions as they come up.
All right.
And
excellent.
So I'll just jump right in.
All right. Thank you.
Just to begin, just sort of a little bit of history. Aviation has an entire chapter of state law, Chapter 360. This chapter covers everything from airports, pilots, airplanes, aircraft, the state's role, and so on and so on. And it's a very broad role. Aeronautics has been around in some form since the 30s or 40s. We were a department for decades, and then in the 70s, as the DOT was formed, as MnDOT was formed, many agencies, including the Department of Aeronautics, were rolled under MnDOT, and so the roles that the Department of Aeronautics had became part of MnDOT's role in aviation. We do everything from collecting taxes directly. When you think about the role of MnDOT and highways, you tend to think mostly infrastructure. When it comes to aviation, our role is a bit broader. So, for example, if you own an airplane, and just like when you own a car, you get your license tabs, you go to the Department of Public Safety for that. For an airplane, when you register your airplane, you come to MnDOT Aeronautics for that. So we collect those taxes directly. We have a statewide planning role for airports. We distribute state and federal funding to airports across the state. We own some infrastructure at airports all around Minnesota, a lot of weather monitoring systems to help pilots do their flight planning, and then also navigational systems. We enforce both state and federal safety standards, provide a lot of technical resources to local government. We educate pilots. One of our roles that's defined in state law is to also try and balance our role with the federal role, with FAA. So when there's things that FAA does a lot of and does well, we tend to not do those, even though state law has that authority in it. We try to not be redundant and try to use our resources very efficiently in that way. Just sort of some broad things to know when it comes to aviation. A lot of what I'm going to talk to you about today is general aviation. When you think of aviation, we tend to categorize it in three ways: airlines, military, and general aviation. So general aviation is everything except the airlines and the military. And we tend to talk about it in terms of general aviation accounts for about 75% of the aviation activity in the United States. It's flight schools, it's training, it's mechanics, it's manufacturers of aircraft, it's business aviation, and on and on. Here in Minnesota, I tell folks we have more airports than we have counties. Many people are surprised by that. There's 135 what we call public airports. Those are airports that are owned by public entities of some kind, and they're open to the general public. Almost all airports are either city-owned or county-owned. There's a few airports in the state that are owned by an airport authority. That's typically an agreement at the local government level between cities and counties over ownership and legal rights and authorities with that airport. There's also also the Metropolitan Airports Commission. That would be an example of an airport authority. That commission is unique in that it was formulated at the state level versus at the local level. But again, of the 135 public airports, 9 of those airports have airline service. 92 of those 135 airports are eligible for federal funding, and I'll talk a bit more about the funding here in a moment. As I said, we have a statewide planning role. We plan for an orderly development of the state's airports. We recently published in July of 2013 our state aviation system plan. It's a very thick document. I did not bring it with me. It is available on our website. It follows Federal Aviation Administration guidelines on preparing that. It has performance measures and outcomes. We did an inventory of all the airports in the state, the condition that they're in, their pavements, their buildings, all of those kinds of things, and compared it against what the goals that are identified in the state aviation system plan. We had public involvement, had many meetings across the state as we put this together. We used this to guide some of our decision making in terms of making investments and choosing projects, and as well as working with communities on how their airport serves either a region or the state in a variety of ways. We at MnDOT are we store the state airports fund. This fund is approximately $20 million a year in revenue. Our primary sources of money come from users of the aviation system. So airports are funded both at the state and federal level by users of aviation. So these are aviation taxes going back into the aviation system. The state airports fund, we have an aviation fuel tax. There's a sales tax and lease tax on aircraft. Airlines pay a tax into this fund in lieu of some other taxes that they might pay. And there's aircraft registration tax. And then, of course, we have some small fees and taxes associated with inspection and licensing that we do. But those are the sources of revenue for the fund. This money, like I said, is dedicated to aviation, so we don't mix money with bigger MnDOT when it comes to highways. So highway money goes to highways, state airports money goes into airports and aviation. As part of the airport system, we have a classification structure that is defined in state law and then also through policy. We have 3 categories of airports: key, intermediate, and landing strip. Key airports are going to be the larger airports in the state, certainly the MSPs, the Duluths, but also Park Rapids, Wilmer, some of the airports that you may not typically think of when you think of large airports, but certainly airports that are large enough for business jets to fly in and out of. They have nice long runways. They can accommodate a wide variety of aircraft. They tend to be where our population and economic centers are. The next level down is going to be the intermediate airports. These are what you would typically think of if you think of a municipal airport, kind of that local airport. And then finally, landing strips. There are quite a few turf runway airports around the state, primarily serving a lot of ag spraying, those kinds of things, but certainly recreational use and other types of aircraft.
So what? Just quickly on your chart.
Sure.
It says 360.305 limit.
That's right. So
less than 40, less than 90, less than 65.
Right. State law limits the size of the state system. So these are the airports that we're providing funding to, and the state airports. So
does. Go ahead.
Everyone's hiding their technology now. 360.305 is the statute reference, and so that's where that limit is, and then we periodically go and look, make sure that's the right size, that sort of thing.
Right.
So we have had more airports in the past. This number of airports in the state has been gradually declining over the decades, and so a maximum of 40, a maximum of 90, a maximum of 65.
Okay. Thank you.
When it comes to federal funding, The FAA has a National Plan of Integrated Airport Systems. We use the acronym more than the long title, so the NIPIUS. And basically what that means is that your airport would be eligible for federal funding. So of the 135 public airports in Minnesota, 97 of those, about 70% of the airports, are eligible and receive federal funding. Minnesota is a Channeling Act state. There are two kinds of states. You're either a block grant state or a Channeling Act state, and it basically defines how the money is managed between the federal government and state government. The federal money flows through the state to the airport. Airports receive entitlement dollars, and they could also receive discretionary dollars. So the entitlement dollars, so again, most of the airports in the state are general aviation airports. They do not have airline service. They would be considered a non-primary airport. They receive $150,000 a year in entitlements. They can also apply for discretionary funding. They compete for those federal funds nationwide. There's a bit of that money also that's called state apportionment, and that is money that's set aside by the federal government that we at MnDOT can then assign to projects. So if there's a particular project that perhaps has a bigger need or is a higher priority in some way, we might assign that state apportionment to that project.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, a question on the you said 70% of the airports are eligible for state or federal dollars, matching, et cetera, et cetera. So is there 30% of the airports that just operate on their own? Are they typically city? I imagine they're is there any private run airports?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, 70% are eligible for federal. 100% of the 135 receive state funding. And, yes, there are private airports, and those private airports do not receive state funding. But so those 30% are basically the state and the city are the ones that support that airport.
And Ms. Isaacson, why is Minnesota a Channeling Act state, and how does a block grant state operate?
So, Mr. Chairman, Minnesota is a Channeling Act state. Many years ago, it's been close to a decade now, the federal government decided to allow, they started a pilot program where 10 states became block grant states. Wisconsin is actually one of those. And basically what it means is that at the state level, the state does some of the things in terms of managing the money and assigning it to airports that the FAA typically would do. This is a year for reauthorization, and the states, one of the things that the states are recommending in total to Congress is that they consider opening that program up so that states that would choose to be block grant states could make that choice. And so we've been working with FAA for some time on that. We haven't decided, you know, should we or shouldn't we, but it gives you some flexibility in moving money amongst airports within the state. It just makes it a bit easier.
So who will make that decision, and how will that decision be made?
Mr. Chairman, if that were to be part of federal reauthorization, we would work with the stakeholders, all the stakeholders across the state, not just the airports, but cities and counties, as well as those in the aviation community, to seek that kind of input as part of that decision-making process. Don't believe there's anything in state law related to that. Today, MnDOT, we act as agent for the airports as it is. The money already comes through us. I don't know if a change would be needed, but we could certainly look into that.
All right. Thank you.
When it comes to the Federal Airport Improvement Program, the AIP program, so each airport gets their entitlement dollars each year. You're eligible for $150,000 this year, $150,000 next year. Some years you may not have a need. And so if you don't have a need to spend that money, if you don't have a project, you can bank it or carry it forward. After you've banked that money, in the fourth year, it then expires. And so, for example, if I don't have a project this year, but, Mr. Chairman, you do have a project, perhaps I would give you my money this year. In exchange, next year you would give me yours. And so then instead of $150,000 to spend, you would have $300,000 to spend. And so we at MnDOT have been taking a much more active role in this in the last year, encouraging airports, particularly if money is going to expire. We really don't want to see that federal money leave the state of Minnesota. Those expiring dollars, that's 90-10 money, 90% federal, 10% local. And so we've really been encouraging airports to transfer, if they've got money that's going to expire, transfer that to another airport in the state. Because what happens at the national level, each year, all the airports across the country identify their projects they're going to do. And that account, and then the federal FAA looks at it and says, okay, here's how much money we're going to have left. They then transform that money to discretionary. That discretionary money is competed for nationwide. So we'd much rather see those dollars spent here in Minnesota. So we've been taking a much more active role in working with airports to make those agreements, to transfer those entitlements. Certainly the expiring, and this year we're focusing more on even the banking entitlements, because $150,000 this year will buy more than the next year and the next year and the next year. You lose buying power on those entitlements from year to year.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify because of the 90-10. So if they have this non-primary, the $150,000 a year, is 90% on top of that $150,000?
Ms. Isaacson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that $150,000 is the amount of federal money that's going to come to them. And so then they need to come up with a 10% to add on to that.
All right. I just wanted to clarify which way that was going. Okay, thank you.
And Ms. Isaacson, the individual airport, or can they tap into like the state's airport?
From the federal perspective, they just so it's not federal dollars.
Okay.
So they can tap into state dollars, local dollars, private dollars. There's a wide variety of methods that money is put together.
Great. Thank you.
So when it comes to the state program and the state airports fund, we provide grants to airports out of the state airports fund. The participation rate, so I told you the federal rate is 90-10. Generally, the state rate varies depending on the types of projects. So, for example, if you're working on a runway project, we have tended to participate at a higher rate than if you're working on, say, a fueling system. And then we've also participated at a higher rate for those airports that are not eligible for those federal funding. So like Senator Westrom was asking about those 30% of airports, those airports, the state has historically participated at a higher rate on their projects than on those projects who have that federal resource available to them. In this current biennium, we have been participating at higher rates than we typically have, and we have also been participating, paying part of the local share for those federal projects. So if you had a 90-10 federal project, it would be 90% federal, 5% state, 5% local. So we've been doing that in this current biennium. We select projects based on a prioritization system, and I'll show you that here in a moment. And then we also have some where it's just sort of a standalone project. But the prioritization system, basically the airports identify the projects. The communities make the choice of what they feel they need or don't need in their airport. They all submit their projects to us. We have a scoring system that we use. So we rank the projects. We look at the project purpose. Is it a safety project? What kind of airport? Is it a key airport, an intermediate airport? What component of the airport? Is this the runway? Is it the arrivals departures building? And the type of project. We create that score and we rank them from highest ranking to lowest ranking. We look at how much money we have available that year and we draw a line. We then offer grants to those airports for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they don't accept the grant. Perhaps they didn't have their environmental documentation quite complete. Perhaps at the local level, the money they were going to use for this airport project, instead they're going to use it for the library. Whatever the reason, sometimes they decide that they don't want to move forward, so then we lower the line. But we always have more projects than there is money, always. We never get to a point where we're like, oh, look at that. We ran out of projects this year. I guess we'll just put the money in the bank and wait till next year. There's always more projects than there are money.
And Ms. Isaacson, in those instances where they're doing the library this year instead of the airport improvement, is that sometimes an instance when they can bank the dollars and draw them in the future?
So, Mr. Chairman, when it comes to the federal dollars, yes. So they have that entitlements rolling, that sort of thing. The state airports fund, we look at it year to year, and so we don't have a guaranteed amount for the construction projects. I should say that, and I should have said that earlier, part of the state airports fund also goes to maintenance and operations grants. So, for example, snow plowing of runways, that's where a portion of this money goes to. So it's a wide array of things that the state airports fund is used for. So if for some reason a project doesn't go forward this year and it's a state-only project or it's a project we're participating in, typically that we keep it on our list, and next year they're right back in the queue being prioritized with all the others. And so
how much do we spend on operations per year?
So for the maintenance and operations, that component of the program, out of the state airports fund, it's usually around $8 million for construction projects and around $6 to $7 million in the maintenance and operations. And then we also have the maintaining of the navigational systems, that sort of thing, that we own. Mm-hmm. That's a portion of that as well. And I will tell you that for a lot of the airports, particularly some of the smaller airports around the state, they would really like to see us putting more in maintenance operations because they don't have as large of capital needs. They feel like they're the size they need to be, so perhaps a runway extension is really more than they want to take on, but, boy, they could really use some help with their utility bills and their insurance and all those other things that come from owning infrastructure. This is the last slide I have for you. When we did the state aviation system plan, we did an inventory of all the airports in the state, and we looked at what are their needs, whether it's pavements of their runways, their condition of their hangars, you name it. We looked across the board, and we did this inventory, and we compared the needs that they have to sort of bring things up to the goals that are in the state aviation system plan for pavement condition, those kinds of things. And we forecasted the state and federal revenue that would be available to meet those needs. So over the next 20 years, so starting in 2012, the need was identified at over $2 billion, and the amount of state and federal revenue to meet that is $855 million. I will say that this does not include MSP. They're unique in their funding structures. So this would be the general aviation airports in the state. Even those commercial service airports, there's nine of them that have airline service. I think for the most part they would consider themselves, their bread and butter is general aviation. It's not just firefighting coming in, emergency responders, ag sprayers, small businesses, big businesses, recreational flying, just that day-to-day in and out of people. MSP is really in terms of airlines being their predominant operation, it would be MSP.
Thank you. Questions, members?
Senator Carlson and Senator Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering how this works with the federal money being able to be shared between airports or being able to be transferred between airports, and then how does that enter into the discussion of what state money goes where?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator, so the way it works for the transfer, basically the FAA wants the two airports to make an agreement with each other. And they don't necessarily have to pay each other back. So an airport could just give its money to another airport in the state. And so once they've made that agreement, They just transfer those entitlement dollars. They still have the same regulations on them. They still have to be for an airport purpose and all of those kinds of things. When it comes to, how much federal money has been attracted to a particular project doesn't necessarily influence how much of the state airport's fund money we might put to it. We tend to have where we would do things on a system-wide method. So, for example, if we're if we have a year where we're participating, where we're going to give 5% for every federal project, we give it across the board versus a picking and choosing. The state apportionment piece, though, the federal money that the state gets to decide, we look at all of the projects that are moving forward, and we have to consider things like, is this project, does it also need discretionary money? So does it need the FAA to make a decision? And do we think this project will compete well nationally? I will tell you that Minnesota has a mature airport system. We have quality airports. We've done a very good job at both the state and local level, and there are some that haven't. And so, for better or worse, if you've done a poor job of taking care of your airports, a poor job of taking care of your pavements, your projects tend to compete better because they're in worse shape. And so things like terminal buildings, things like that, they really don't compete well nationally. And so we take that into consideration when we're assigning that state apportionment.
Thank you.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first, Ms. Isaacson, I just, as a pilot and plane owner in Minnesota, I'd compliment you and your office. I've always found everybody to be very helpful, very courteous, easy office to work with. So
thank you.
I want you to know. That's appreciated. And I would share that, you know, that 135 airports members is really nice when you run into mechanical trouble or weather that changes rapidly in our state. It's not like you can just pull off the road like you might with an automobile. So while you might think, wow, we have more airports than counties, that's a really good thing because 20, 30 miles can be a life or death matter in those situations. I did want a slide that would have been great would be sort of the maybe last decade of the airport fund and allocation levels in Minnesota, just for us to touch on, maybe for some whose memories aren't as long. I think we went about a decade with borrowing from that fund, and if I'm not mistaken, 2013 was the first time we fully funded the airport fund back up to its statutory allocation again. Just wondering if my memory on that is correct.
Ms. Isaac.
Mr. Chair, Senator Reinhart, I'll put together that information and get it to the committee. And the last decade has been definitely volatile. Aviation is a bumpy business. There's just no doubt about it. And at the state level, we've had some challenges. At the federal level, we've had a lot of challenges. We all hear about continuing resolutions, but we don't always feel the impact. When it comes to highways, for example, most states are able to, they have enough money in their highway coffers that as the federal money bounces up and down because of continuing resolutions and things like that, there's enough money at the state level to keep the cash flow going so that projects can kind of keep moving forward. That's simply not true in aviation. We simply don't have those resources, and particularly because most airports are owned by local government. They cannot front the cash in order to keep those projects moving. So a decade of continuing resolutions for aviation has been very difficult. That's been a part of, as the $15 million that was taken out of the state airports fund to help balance the general fund, when it was reinstated, I was asked, well, you know, are you going to spend 15? I said, you know what, we've got to ramp that up to get the airports back into getting their environmental documentation in order, all of that. So in fiscal year 14, we spent an additional $1 million over our tip. We came with a supplemental budget, so we spent an additional $1 million. This year, fiscal year 15, we're on track to spend an additional $3 million. All of that is going to construction projects and maintenance and operations of the airport. We at MnDOT Aeronautics aren't taking any of that. And then as you'll see the budget information coming forward, we would hope to spend additional money in both 16 and 17, and that would account for that total of that $15 million.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone else in the legislature was happy about paying the school shifts back. This committee was celebrating paying back the $15 million bucks.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you, so we, there's a lot of documents that go with giving a grant. So we send to the local government this pile of paper. It's got attorneys that sign it. It's notarized. It comes back to us. We have signatures. Our attorneys have signatures. And when we got some of those back, there were handwritten thank you notes from some of those communities thanking for that extra participation. They had projects that they simply could not have gotten to were it not for the state of Minnesota participating at a higher rate.
Anything further, members? Great. Well, thank you. This is an excellent presentation. I learned a lot.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. So I will invite Tom Warner and Michael Lawrence forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Tom Warner. I'm the Executive Director of the Duluth Airport, and I'm grateful to Senator Reinert for the invitation to address you today. A number of topics. In your packet, you received a slide deck that will be the guide for what I'll go over today. Basically, what I wanted to do is come down and talk about past state involvement, state investment in the Duluth Airport, then transition to what we've got in the pipeline now that doesn't necessarily have state involvement, but much more local participation that also is crucial to the airport and its economic standing in our area, and then talk about what we have coming in the future. So on the second slide, you see what we'll be talking about today, and on the third slide, we'll kind of dive into what the airport is. Just for your reference, the Duluth Airport Authority was enacted by state legislation, state charter in 1969. It's composed of a board of directors of seven appointed by the mayor of the city of Duluth. We recently, in the last 2 years, have updated our vision and mission statement, and as you can see, we take very, very seriously our role as an economic driver for the economy of our region, and we hope to illustrate that in the upcoming slides. The next page, a little bit more about what the airport is. We see ourselves as a regional asset, as we talked about in the vision and mission statements. 3,100 acres of airport property. We have a main runway, which is on your sheet of paper, east, west, or left to right of over 2 miles in length. A concrete reinforced runway can land virtually anything in the world. We have a crosswind runway of 5,700 feet, instrument approaches, air traffic control that runs 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, and available property for development. So we really are, in terms of aviation, a center of gravity in northern Minnesota, and have the ability to grow. All of this, exists to support air commerce, economic growth, and most importantly, jobs. And really, I think, whether it be the staff, the board of directors, or the airport infrastructure itself, we really do see ourselves as economic drivers. So the next slide talks about some of the aviation partners that we have. You can't talk about what the airport is without talking about some of the individual companies and the employees that make up the airport community. You see some of the brands of the companies listed there, and above there you see some footnotes. AAR, an aircraft Airbus manufacturer that is in the old Northwest maintenance base up in Duluth, has four lines of Airbus maintenance going on. They are the second largest aviation employer in our region. Up in northern Minnesota, they have 379 full-time employees, and that is in less than a three-year time frame that they've been able to ramp up to that amount. And they are growing. Interestingly enough, they are looking long-term at an expansion. So very, very successful story with a new employer post-recession in our area. Another one, Northstar Aerospace, manufacturer of precision parts, smaller employer with 41 full-time employees, but the precision parts in the aerospace industry are recognized nationally. Monaco Air is our fixed-base operator and handles much of our general aviation component in and out of the airport. They are internationally recognized for their impeccable service, and clients do seek them out when entering into the United States. They also have 28 full-time employees. One of the newer relationships that we have is with Lake Superior College. They're a Minscu system school. They have started the Center for Advanced Aviation and have started to grow those programs in helping the industry grow tomorrow's talent. We'll talk more about them in a later slide, so I won't hit that one too hard right now. The Air National Guard's 148th Fighter Wing with over 1,000 airmen. I mean, those are real jobs and compliments to some of the full-time employment that happens during the week. There's a lot of synergy there, and they've been nationally recognized throughout the Air Force for their excellence. We're extremely proud to have them. And finally, I'll just take a mention real quick of Cirrus, aircraft manufacturer. Many of you know Cirrus. The Cirrus brand is recognized internationally. They are the second largest general manufacturer in our region, and that cuts across multiple sectors, with currently 625 full-time employees, and they are growing. We've been working with Cirrus. Excuse me. They are on the cusp of another major expansion as they bring their jet program online. And that will, for our region, add another 150 to 200 jobs in the next 2 years. So companies like Cirrus are seeing opportunity there, and that is translating into real economic development. The next slide is a deed study that was completed in 2007, which represents our last economic impact study, where it talks about the Duluth International Airport alone has a regional impact of $1.3 billion. You see the circled number of direct and indirect jobs of 4,434 total jobs that rely on that airport for its presence, either directly or indirectly. So it is a large impact on the region in the area. The next slide. I wanted to take a couple of minutes to say thank you. In recent years, the state legislature has shown great leadership and vision in supporting some of our infrastructure projects. We recently completed a $70 million terminal project. Some of you, I'm sure, have seen it. For others that haven't, it is an absolutely iconic building, and really, really proud to have that be the gateway to our community. So we're extremely happy to have it, as well as a new parking ramp, and we'll get into those here in a couple of slides. But that could not have happened without state bonding dollars in the amount of $16.6 million, really, really crucial to the success of both those projects. The next slide is simply a picture tour, and I apologize, the black and white doesn't do some of the pictures justice. In the upper left-hand corner, we have our ticketing area. In the old terminal, ticketing for multiple airlines was accommodated throughout the building. There was a cross flow of passenger and customer traffic. It was very, very confusing and not a very inviting experience. This expansive ticketing area has all of our airline offerings in the same spot for a very efficient and welcoming experience. We have currently three regular airline service there, Delta, United, and Allegiant, as well as all of our air carrier charters in that area as well.
Members, the slideshow is posted online at the committee website if you want to look at them in color, living color.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The upper right-hand corner is our passenger seating area, our concourse, if you will, post-security. It boasts 400-seat capacity. And again, if you had ever experienced post-9/11 security at the old Duluth International Terminal, it was extremely difficult. We had affectionately called our post-screening areas the fishbowls because they were large glass enclosures. You were tightly packed in there, and there was no restrooms, no concessions. Extremely uncomfortable experience, and so we were glad to divest ourselves of that.
Senator Thomasoni,
Chairman, I thought they were more like being in prison than being
an official. Fair enough, Mr. Senator.
Mr. Warner.
So again, very, very inviting experience, and in a couple of slides, I'm going to talk about our passenger numbers over the last few years, and I think that will illustrate the point. The next slide is our most recent project completion of our four-level parking ramp. That's been wildly successful, especially we opened that in November of 2014, right before the snow fell up north. And it's amazing how people have flocked to that in the winter months. There's 320 parking spots in that four-level facility. We have rental car pickup available inside on the bottom floor. It's connected to the terminal via Skywalk. And so it, very, very nice benefit, very inviting to the traveler. So I mentioned earlier on the next slide, I'll mention briefly our air carrier service. As Director Isaacson mentioned in the last brief, our airport does service primarily general aviation traffic. However, the economic driver that is air carrier traffic, the ability to connect businesses to clients and customers throughout the country and the world can't be understated. Duluth's air carrier service is critical to the success of the airport as well as the region's businesses as a whole. We do have connections to four major cities right now, Las Vegas, Minneapolis, Chicago, and Detroit. And with the growth of the air carrier industry now post-recession, we see our ability to partner with airlines to expand that as being a real possibility in the coming years. If oil prices are able to stabilize at a lower level, we think that that could be a possibility. The passenger numbers reflected on the slide, so just to put it in perspective, what has been the passenger strength at Duluth in volume? 2012, we saw 326 air carrier passengers come through our door. That was the second best passenger year ever. 2013, 317 total passengers for our third best year ever. And last year, we just received the numbers. We were slightly off by less than 1% of the 2013 mark, with 313,000 passengers for our fourth best year ever. And so to put that all into perspective, we've seen growing post-recession demand for air carrier service at Duluth, and that demand will turn into future opportunity with the airlines down the road.
One moment. Senator Peterson.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Werder, could I have you expand a little bit on the air carrier service? Right now, does your airport authority, do they supplement the costs of those air carriers, or the term I've heard is kind of buy tickets at this point, or are those air carriers self-supporting with a higher percentage of ridership?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, we do not subsidize tickets at all at Duluth. We've been fortunate that our demand has been strong enough that we've been able to foster strong competition. And through competition, as it does in any industry, keeps prices down. Now, if we lost our secondary, I don't want to call them secondary, our competitive carriers like United, who isn't the doesn't have the largest market share, if we lost Allegiant, and we became only a Delta community, much like Northwest was very dominant throughout the state and Duluth for many, many years, tickets, prices, and fares would skyrocket. And so we've been able to maintain competition, and that has kept fares in check, relatively speaking, for our size community.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Werner, then, so do you have a sense for, like, I'm interested in United or SkyWest. I mean, do they have, like, a 75% load rate or 80%? Do you know? Have you ever heard any numbers from
those? We track those fairly closely. I can tell you on an annual basis, SkyWest is our predominant United carrier at Duluth. They're above 74-75% load factors on a consistent basis. So that will fluctuate and be even stronger at certain times of the year. I can tell you all summer long we had four frequencies to Chicago's O'Hare, and right now we've got three. But that seasonal surge is because of high demand. So the load factors and the demand are there at certain times of the year.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Continue. Oh, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, you talked about Cirrus Industries. Do you know kind of what they're where they're at, just in, you know, in their business? And where I'm going with my question is, some years back, I remember talking to some Transportation Committee members that had toured the plant, and there was I think it was this company. Maybe it's a different company in Duluth. But there was always discussion about a small little plane, a little Jetson-type concept. And they always felt that that might be the first company that really comes out with something that's practical and maybe achieves that concept that we all are familiar with, the cartoon, of course. But any comment on that, or is that still something being talked about, or is that,
well,
is that just scrapped?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I don't know that we're any closer to seeing a Jetsons-style vehicle anytime soon. I can tell you that they have a very active research and development program, and that is where the small jet that will now go to mass production very, very soon, that came out of that program. I can tell you that that probably won't be the last concept that will go to mass production out of Cirrus. It's a very, very strong brand, a very, very innovative company, and so they are really, truly looking for different ways to make general aviation affordable to recreational pilots as well as business owners. So they have a very, very bright future ahead of them.
Mr. Chair, the jet concept, can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
So the jet concept is simply, it's a 4-to-6 seat aircraft, much like in size a single engine aircraft, a Cirrus SR-20 that some of you may be familiar with. However, it has a single turbine engine in it, a jet engine above the cabin. And so, if you haven't seen that, I'd encourage you to contact Cirrus and get up and see that aircraft, because it is really a revolutionary concept, and we're really excited to see that come online.
Senator Reinert.
And just to follow on, I had to step out for a minute, and I don't, Tom may have mentioned, but the pre-order number is around 500 at several thousand dollars deposit for each pre-order.
Yes, Cirrus is an internationally recognized brand. They've expanded quite heavily, have a presence in Europe now, a presence in China. Very, very fortunate to have such a predominant name based out of northern Minnesota that has national recognition. Moving on to the next slide here, I promised I'd talk a little bit more about Lake Superior College's Center for Advanced Aviation. One of the local investments that we've made is recognizing that this program can really help us with our talent development in northern Minnesota. So we recently partnered with Lake Superior College to put them in one of our vacant hangars that will serve as a permanent home for that school. Lake Superior College has been very responsive to industry. Industry has cited where they have issues in their talent pipeline, the inability to recruit or attract the necessary talent to fill their needs. And Lake Superior College has taken that challenge on. And so the ability to grow your own up in that area is a huge, huge bonus for us. They've been very responsive to the demand. AAR alone, just to paint the picture, in terms of Airbus aviation mechanics, they're called A&Ps, Airframe and Power Plant, was projected to be 100 mechanics alone short by themselves last year. That's a major job deficit, and one that almost borders on crisis. And so we need to, as a community, establish a talent pipeline where we start growing our own in that area to keep up with attrition. There will always be need for recruitment from outside the region, but the ability to grow your own in that community will be a huge, huge bonus for us. So, and Cirrus and all folks that would need A&P mechanics up there, we're discussing the same type of issue. So we're very excited that that's coming online. It will have pilot training program. It will have a program for A&P mechanics that can be used for the new Delta Airbus facility down here at MSP, as well as many of the needs up north as well. And just also highlight on the A&P program, so cohorts, if you aren't familiar with educational terms, cohort is a set of students that go through the program within a day, weeks, program's time. They now have two cohorts of A&P mechanics in the system, and so they've got a day course and a night course. And so the demand has been very, very high. Response has been excellent from the community.
Madam Chair?
Senator Wicker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Werner, that's great about the partnership with the college. Is there participation as well in the tuition? And I'm assuming these graduates have a job waiting for them.
They do. So, some of that, Senator, some of those programs aren't well defined yet. The program in that hangar isn't up and running yet. I can tell you that Lake Superior College has been actively talking with both Cirrus and AR as two prime examples of this, where internships work alongside somebody that's already in the trade. This hangar, it doesn't show up well on the map, but is literally next across the parking lot from Cirrus. The ability to finish your classwork and go and stand alongside a mechanic that's actively working in the industry is absolutely critical. And so those programs will be coming online.
Great.
Finally, I wanted to round out my brief with talking about the future. So we've talked about past state investment, and I wanted to talk about some of what we're projecting for need in the future.
I'm going to interrupt you. My apologies. Senator Please. Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you were just in the process of in between there, but on your subject back on the education side of it, is that a two-year, four-year woven together type program, or is it a certificate educational program?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a great question. So there's a couple of different options here. There is a certificate that can be achieved in a year's time frame, but the bulk of the program is a two-year program. So if you do the comprehensive A&P program, it would be a two-year commitment at the school. The reason why they offered a couple of different tiers is demand is now. And so the ability to get certificated mechanics into the pipeline now, working in what capacity that they can within the limits of the FA, was extremely important. So there is that tier system available.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I think one of my other questions is that I know that the unmanned aerial vehicles is another area of high job demand. Sometimes that works with an aviation facility. I noticed you have an avionics future,
mm-hmm.
but the UAVs, is there anything like that in the pipeline as well?
Mr. Warner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you. So we haven't had any real discussions, at least not with me at the table, about complementing a drone program of any kind. Avionics is kind of the next target on their list. But as I said before, they've been extremely responsive to industry. And so expansion in many, many different ways is they're very interested in growing the program. I would not be surprised if there's strong interest that they would take that on. Another area of interest that is something that I've been pushing for is we are about to see another influx of retirements now in the air traffic control system nationwide. Okay, and when that hits, there aren't a lot of programs to spin up new ones in short order. Our air traffic control tower in Duluth, I don't know if you've been following it enough or not, but during sequestration was subject to possibly the cutting of hours down so that they would close this at night and limit our ability to use that as an aviation navigational asset. One of the things that I want to do is have the college take up the charge of training tomorrow's air traffic control towers, use that tower as a training facility side by side with those working in the industry today, one, to breathe new life into our air traffic control tower as a asset that really is of value to the FAA, not only to local pilots. So it's those types of innovations that we're looking at in terms of the program, but I can tell you the college's leadership has been very responsive to those ideas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, members, I'm just going to draw your attention to the time, and we have a whole other segment of presentations to get through. So, Mr. Warner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My last slide, I just simply wanted to point out that while we've done a lot to maintain our infrastructure in the past, we've made some improvements. We've made local investments, and the industry, the aviation sector in the area is very strong. But as you can see, success in leveraging our economic opportunity and job creation doesn't stop there. We have in the future the need to rebuild, repair, and extend our runways at the Duluth International Airport. I started out by talking about we have a 2-mile-long runway and we have a crosswind. What's driving this is the two-mile-long runway was built in the 40s, extended in the 50s. It has met its useful life. We have maintained it up to this point. Now we are seeing the end of that useful lifespan, and in the next decade, we will need to take it offline for up to three construction seasons to do a full-depth reconstruction. Now, in northern Minnesota, that presents a lot of challenges because good weather is hard to come by during certain times of the year. And so 3 years of disruption to air commerce, to military training with the 148th, we were forced with trying to find a workaround. How could we preserve air commerce? How could we preserve the mission of the 148th during that time? We looked at our crosswind runway as a solution to that. So where the highway side, if you've got a major artery that you need to rebuild, you probably are going to look at beefing up a bypass on the highway side. That's how we look at our crosswind runway right now in terms of this project, beefing it up to allow the 148th to continue with their mission and to allow air commerce to continue. I won't get too much into more detail with that. We estimate at this early stage that the extension and rehabilitation of our crosswind runway by itself about 5 years from now will cost approximately $30 million. There are long-term benefits to not only air commerce, but the long-term viability of the 148th in the state of Minnesota and those 1,000 jobs that come with it. But we'll save that for another time. Pending your questions, that concludes my briefing.
Thank you, Mr. Warner. Questions, members?
All right.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. Welcome, Mr. Lawrence.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you. My name is Michael Lawrence. I promise I'll be brief here. I'm the immediate past president of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association and currently serve on the Board of Directors. I live in Lino Lakes, and I manage Key Air Twin Cities. It's a fixed-based operator at the Anoka County Airport in Blaine. We're basically terminal, hangar, and fuel services for business aircraft. I'm here today to just quickly highlight some of the benefits that business aviation brings to the state and answer any questions I can based on my work daily in the industry. The MBAA is a membership of over 600 people working in general aviation flight departments or businesses that directly support the operation of general aviation aircraft, both here in the metro air and in outstate as well. Organization has worked successfully here with our legislators in the past, and we'll continue to work to find ways to maintain and improve Minnesota's aviation system while keeping costs competitive with our neighboring states as well as nationally. The great system of airports in this state are vital for many businesses to operate globally yet stay competitive by utilizing labor in all corners of the state, not just here in the metro area. While there are over 5,000 airports in the country, only 500 are served by the airlines. Smaller airports used less frequently around the state are still very important for those communities they serve by attracting businesses and providing access for those businesses and their vendors and suppliers to move people and products quickly and efficiently. A very small list of examples include Polaris Industries and the Roseau Airport, Marvin Windows and Doors in the War Road Airport, Fastenal Company in the Winona Airport, the Schwann Food Company in the Marshall Airport, and Hormel Foods in the Austin Airport. Again, very small list. But these companies could not compete at the same level in these communities without the access an airport provides. In addition to businesses, many air ambulance flights happen every single day, moving critical patients from small outstate communities to more capable hospitals in larger communities. And again, that couldn't happen without the robust system of airports that we have here in the state. Working together, we've made steps to move in the right direction, and positive results can be attributed to those changes. Minnesota has a better airport system and navigational aids than our neighboring states, but we also have the highest cost of aircraft registration and fuel taxes among our neighbors. Business aircraft are tools, and general aviation is an important economic driver and high-paying job creator. These business tools, like other business tools, whether it be computers, telephones, your trucks, your CNC machines, and any type of businesses, they all need to be continually maintained and upgraded. The difference with aircraft, though, is you can move that to another state to be upgraded or maintained in order to save taxes on the state that it's based in. There's nothing keeps you tied here. So it's important for those businesses to operate their flight departments as efficiently as possible. And it's important for us to adequately continue to fund the aviation system of Minnesota, yet remain competitive to keep those businesses and their aircraft in this state as well as maintained and upgraded in this state. along with all the jobs that go with both. So thank you for giving me the time to present this morning. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Great.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. We'll add Digitech and Thief River Falls. We always hear that story.
Very
similar. Always on the list. Senator Franzen and Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lawrence, you mentioned a lot of examples on export trade and not only our capacity nationally but growing it globally. Can you expand on what our capacity looks like, particularly in the import side and where we both import and export? But you haven't mentioned some of the import that we do by way of airport traffic and where we rank compared to other states and maybe compared to different regions, east and west.
That's far deeper than I'd have knowledge for at this time. But I do know through watching, like I say, I work on the airport every day and I see aircraft wherever they're flying. Bemidji Aviation is a huge asset to UPS and FedEx for connecting packages throughout the state using all of the airports. But on an import side of things, it's just a little deeper than I know.
Mr. Chair, and if there's a way we can get some of that information, that would be great for the committee, I think, to understand also where we rank nationally and where we need to perhaps have more resources to grow our capacity to be not only a great export state but also have trade across state lines and globally.
Well, Senator Tomasoni's committee provide that information from Deed for us. We'll figure out something. Why don't we talk more and figure out what we need and who to get it from. Thanks. It's good information to have. Senator Pratt. Senator Franzen, were you done? Yep. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lawrence, interesting at the end you talked about how it's easy for the aircraft industry to move. Wondering how do our, and you mentioned specifically taxes, how does our tax structure compare to, say, the five-state region today? And are there any taxes in particular that you think the industry might be more sensitive to?
Mr. Lawrence.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think one of the biggest issues is our aircraft registration tax. The highest neighboring state, the most it would cost to register that aircraft is $5,000, whereas the highest level for a business aircraft in our state is $75,000. So it's advantageous for some companies who have multiple offices throughout the country to register the aircraft in another state if it so benefits them financially. We have made improvements, significant improvements, in the last few years, so I can't talk too bad about it because we're headed in the right direction. But what I would like to say is, I mean, neighboring states, both the registration tax and fuel tax are still significantly lower than ours.
Senator Pratt, and Senator Rest can give you a tutorial. She's been working on these issues over many years now, trying to find the right balance between the various fuel, registration, sales, all the... Senator, I'm sorry?
We're going to have a new proposal this year that we hope that you will entertain a hearing on.
We're going to have it in the discussion in the context of our Trunk Highway Fund and
yes.
sources and outflows, yes. Right. Yes.
Non-highway use of... The policy regarding gas tax for non-highway use vehicles, and in this case, airplanes.
Yes, we will. Of course, we will absolutely have a hearing
in support of the airport fund.
Yes,
we'll see how it goes.
All right, indeed, we will. I have an open mind, just for the record, Senator Pratt.
No, that's fine, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Anything else, members? Thank you, Mr. Lawrence.
Thank you very much.
All right. Now we're going to hear about other kinds of ports. So we have Mr. Finau from MnDOT Freight Office, Randy Olson, an old friend of mine from Red Wing, Lori Lauder, and Deb DeLuca. So anyone who wants to come forward now, please do so. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair, members. My name is Patrick Fino. I am the program coordinator for Ports and Waterways in MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. Thank you for having me here today. I'm just going to give you a quick overview of our Ports and Waterways system and MnDOT's role in that system. And I'm going to try to be very brief because my colleagues in the at the Port Authorities have extremely important information for you. Minnesota is uniquely situated as a state so far inland in that we have direct waterway access to both the Atlantic through the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Seaway, as well as to the Gulf of Mexico via the Mississippi River. Here in Minnesota, we have four ports on Lake Superior, Duluth Superior being by far the largest port. They account for about 60% of the tonnage moved on the lakes in Minnesota and about half of the overall tonnage for the entire waterway system in the state. On the river, we have from south to north on the Mississippi, Winona, Red Wing, and St. Paul port authorities. And then for a few more months, we've got the Minneapolis Harbor at the head of navigation on the Mississippi. And then finally, the ports of Savage, a collection of private terminals on the Minnesota River. Last September, we completed our first ever statewide ports and waterways plan. It does a couple things. It gives a little bit of context for the history and the current state of the system and MnDOT's various roles in that. It also describes some of the economic benefits of the system as well as how that system is funded through various methods. A small portion from the state, but primarily from private sector, port authorities, and federal government. And then we finished that with a list of opportunities and challenges as well as some strategies to address those challenges. And this is just a couple of highlights of the opportunities and challenges from that plan. The infrastructure on the system is very old. Most of the locks are, I think, in excess of 50 years old. There's also a need for dredging throughout the system, and particularly in Minnesota and the upper Mississippi, with addressing placement of dredge disposal material. And quickly, for I'm not sure if everyone is entirely aware of dredging. It's basically just dragging the sediment from the bottom of the river and the harbor area in the lakes to maintain a consistent channel, 9 feet on the river and 28 feet on the lakes.
I'm sorry, how many feet on a lake?
I'm
28 or 20 feet on the lake?
28 feet on the Great Lakes. I'm not sure quite the extent of where all that dredging occurs. I think I might leave that to Ms. DeLuca.
Great, thanks.
We also address planning coordination issues with agencies and jurisdictions that are affected by freight movement on the waterways, address road and rail access to ports. It's the system is dependent on more than just the water. We obviously need ways to get commodities to and from the ports. And then finally, we have a few regional groups that we work with that are both multi-state and also across national borders. Two examples of that are the Upper Mississippi River Basin Association for the Upper River and the Council of Great Lakes Governors for the Great Lakes. And we get together to work on policy issues that affect those systems in general.
Mr. Fino, does the plan touch on any environmental issues like invasive species?
Mr. Chair, members, it does briefly. The bulk of the plan addresses navigation issues, but we do briefly address the invasive species.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question in regards to the St. Anthony Falls. I remember some time in the past there was some proposals or discussion to consider using this area as an electricity generating that would have used the current of the waters without affecting the environment in regards to the water coming back on stream. It seemed to me there was a lot of common sense to that, just pulling the power out. The movement of the water is an age-old methodology. It seemed like with its access to immediate needs in the downtown area, do you recall that, and is there anything like that a possibility?
Well, I can take a first stab.
Oh, wonderful.
So we did, a generator was added to Army Corps of Engineers facility just below the falls where there's another kind of gateway area. And at present, there are no less than three proposals under consideration. As a matter of fact, there's just an article in the Star Tribune over the weekend
And I'll zip the link to you about three different competing proposals. Well, I don't even know if they're competing. They might all be fine to use the water in that area for generation. The old Crown Hydro that we've discussed quite a bit in the past, but they're looking at new sites and then two others.
Well, that's encouraging to hear, Mr. Chairman, and it seems like probably about the cleanest energy that you can draw would be from making use of that, and especially with our technologies today, to not interrupt the flow.
The turbines are a lot smaller and generate a lot more electricity.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, do you know the kilowatts on that potential?
Okay. Read the article as closely as I should have. I just skimmed it, but I'll read it more closely and I'll share it with you.
You gave wonderful information, and I reward you by asking a specific on kilowatts. And,
all right.
Wonderful.
Did you want to add anything, Mr. Fino?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Senator, I have no more information than that.
All right. Great.
Thank you.
Last summer, we finally, the federal government finally passed an updated Water Resources Reform and Development Act. Did a number of things. It mandated the closure of the Upper St. Anthony Falls Lock and Dam by no later than June 10th of 2015. It did a number of things that do not directly affect navigation on Minnesota waterways, but those include full use of the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund. It currently, I think, is utilized at about 50%, and this will slowly move to full use of, full use on the waterways of that trust fund by 2025. It also authorizes a number of U.S. Army Corps projects. None of those are navigation-related in Minnesota, though. It also addresses ecosystem protection, flood protection, innovative financing, and some things to speed up project delivery. In 2013, on Minnesota's waterways in the Great Lakes, we moved about 58 million tons of commodities. The majority of that, like I said, is Blue Superior. The majority of that is also outbound from that port. Generally, over the past decade or so, that number has ranged from 60 to 70 million. So this 2013 was slightly on the low end, though not the lowest that we've seen in the last decade. On the river, like you see, is about 9 million tons, and that number over the last decade has varied from about 6 to 10 million, so slightly on the higher side of the river. Unfortunately, I don't have 2014 numbers compiled yet, but those should be available relatively soon. Just a quick recap of the 2014 shipping season. Both systems got off to a late start. I believe the Great Lakes was a historically late start. The last salty didn't arrive until May 7th. Salty being ships that ply the oceans as well as the lakes. The U.S. Coast Guard and the Canadian's equivalent agency were required to do a great deal of ice breaking to move ships through the lakes. But later in the season, high water and a relatively mild start to the winter allowed the Great Lakes to recover much of that slow start for the season. Like I said, the river system also got off to a very late start. Wasn't quite historically late, but it was still very late. And then towards the middle of the season, and I think towards the early end as well, they experienced a great deal of flooding, followed by relatively sudden low water, which caused severe dredging issues. And that system also closed about a week early. But after that, even still, early reports from the Corps say that tonnage is still up a little bit over last year. Just a quick list of the commodities that we move on the Great Lakes in Minnesota. Like I said, the majority of it is outbound, and the vast majority of that is taconite in the Iron Range. A similar list for the river. Inbound versus outbound, this is a little bit more split. I believe it was slightly higher in 13 coming into Minnesota than going out of Minnesota. The outbound is majority grain. Inbound, the majority of it is fertilizer and cement. The Army Corps of Engineers, they are responsible for maintaining the navigation channel on the Great Lakes, as well as doing maintenance and operation of the locks and dams. I don't have a slide for it, but the Coast Guard is responsible for ace navigation, general safety, as well as maintaining the rules of the road. And finally, to MnDOT's small but vital role in the system. In 1991, the Port Development Assistance Program was created, and 5 years later funded for the first time. The vast majority of this grant funding goes to the four public port authorities in the state, Duluth, St. Paul, Redding, Red Wing, and Winona. And that program is to provide infrastructure dollars for projects such as road and rail access, terminal upgrades, dock wall rehab and reconstruction, and a very small amount of dredging for projects, not any maintenance dredging. And since 1998, MnDOT has invested $25 million in 34 projects. You can see there a list of the funding we've gotten in the last 9 to 10 years. You'll notice we don't get funding every single year. And with those dollar amounts, just as a reminder, that is shared between all four ports. And that's at a maximum 80% MnDOT share, state share, and minimum 20% local share.
You know, when bonding occurs, is it usually in pursuit of a specific project or package of projects, or is it to fund into the fund, and then there's some sort of a grant process out of that fund?
Mr. Chair, it is almost always just a grant to the program. I think there have been a few cases where a specific project was addressed in the appropriation, but for the most part, it's straight to the program.
So dollars go into the fund out of the bonding bill, and then there's some sort of deliberation?
Yep. Mr. Chair, my office puts out essentially an RFP in the state register.
I see.
And then the port authorities send in their applications for projects.
Great. Thank you.
And just for a little bit of recent context, in 2012, there was a $3 million bond appropriation, and these are the projects that each of the four port authorities used those funds for. Duluth was able to use those funds as part of their local match to get a $10 million Tiger grant for a $16 or $17 million rehabilitation of their C&D dock. Winona and Red Wing have almost entirely, if not entirely, completed their projects. Duluth and St. Paul are expecting to begin construction in this spring construction season. Any questions?
Thank you. Questions, Member Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Fino? Thank you. Great presentation. What I'm seeing missing, that I wonder if it's within your purview or you can direct us to it, but the safety aspect of ports, can you talk about that? I've heard through business circles that there's a pretty grave concern about where we are as a state in terms of our safety investments, and particularly in our ports. Of course, we heard more about the airports for obvious reasons in our history, but the ports are certainly maybe not as high up in the hierarchy or in the purview of people's minds, but certainly when you come to see the volume of trade happening and what your role is within the state commerce, can you talk about what improvements or what funding and the status of our ports in terms of safety?
So, Senator Franzen, external threats or, like, accidents?
Both, but particularly, more of the global safety hazards that we've heard, more lately with Homeland Security, your collaborations there, and anything that your department works with in terms of where we are at in comparison to other states as well. Are we on top of our safety status and whatnot? Whatever you can say about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm afraid there's very little that my office does in terms of safety. And I don't know. I'll let the individual port authorities speak to that. But the only real direct role that we have is through that funding program. And to my knowledge, that addresses infrastructure regarding the ability to move commerce. And I don't think any of that really specifically addresses safety. And we don't have any type of regulatory or policing role. I believe that would be the Coast Guard who would have that role.
Louder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori Lauder, St. Paul Port Authority. I think it's probably individual to the ports. I'll speak to St. Paul, if I might, for a moment. Several years ago, as Homeland Security became so important, we worked with the local police department and our harbor operator and put in some funds for some additional security as far as cameras and lights and so forth. The other thing is our harbor operator works very closely with Homeland Security, just in terms of the day-to-day safety with the ships, the boats, the barges, and what that means in terms of folks that maybe shouldn't be there but maybe are, and I haven't heard of any incidents, but a very close relationship there, so I hope that's helpful.
Mr. Chair, well, it is helpful, so thank you, but it's also alarming that we can't have a bigger discussion of where our safety is with regards to that collaboration. It seems like, to me, again, looking at the big of a role that ports play in our state, that we probably would have maybe some more resources for that, or particularly more attention to it. And maybe it is Homeland Security and maybe at a federal level versus state, but I like to know what's our state role in making sure that we're prepared for any hazard, whether it's, you know, something that can come through those lines or something just as a, you know, a hazard that might happen in the course of business, but particularly any threats to our ports, because they're certainly an entryway to our state and our country.
Senator Franzen, I feel an informational hearing coming on. Homeland Security and all reports to our committee, so we'll bring them in and you can ask the question.
Thank you.
Of them as well. Senator Reiner.
Chairman, exactly. That was my thought. It might just be a topic for another day.
Sure.
Living in Duluth, certainly I know that those activities are occurring. I wouldn't want anyone listening to think that they're not. The Coast Guard, at least in our port, plays a big role in that. So I know we're focused more on economic development today, so maybe that is something we could take a look at
hearing. That's an excellent question.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. Sure. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fina, you touched briefly on dredging, and I know that's a particular issue at the Port of Savage. Do we have the resources necessary to keep that waterway open as far as storage of dredge or even the ability to keep the operation running? Or what else do we need to do along that whole Lower Mann watershed?
Maybe address the amount of sediment that goes into the Minnesota River would
well,
be a good
and,
start.
And that's a no, that's actually a very good question, Mr. Chair, because it is coming up from the south and
right.
from the agricultural lands, and so I understand that.
Right. Mr. Fino.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, MnDOT actually has a very limited role as far as that goes. We have no ability to help out the Army Corps with funding. Apparently they've been asked if there's a role for states or local governments to do that, and the answer has consistently been no. It's you know, funded through the federal funding process for the Army Corps. As far as finding places to put that material, that is a pretty big problem. The Lower Minnesota Watershed District was set up to basically take care of that issue. And I don't know if they're in crisis state yet, but again, MnDOT, we don't, that role is left up to local governments and the port authorities.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So am I to understand that the constraints from any sort of MnDOT involvement is based on federal constraints and not constraints that you have from the state, or is it both?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I guess I'm
not
good. Entirely sure what the answer to that question is. I think probably the answer is both. The Army Corps, their responsibility is to get the sediment out of the river, and the local responsibility is to provide them with a place to put that. And the Army Corps works with the local government to make that as easy as they can within their role or within their constraints. So, yeah, like I said, I think the answer is both. locally and federally.
Well, thank you. That helps.
Right. So, members, we really do want to hear from the individual port authorities, mm-hmm. and we don't want to rush them too much. We only have 5 minutes left officially in committee, but I go a little long, just FYI. All right. Thank you, Mr. Reno. I have Mr. Olson, Ms. Lauder, and Ms. DeLuca. You can go in any order you would like. All right. Welcome.
So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Randy Olson. I'm the executive director of the Red Wing Port Authority, and we have oversight of the Mississippi River as it flows through Red Wing and several commercial leases and recreational leases through marinas that we have oversight, and then we serve as the city's economic development agency. And in the interest of time, I'm actually just going to focus on a couple of paragraphs on my presentation and cite a specific port project in Red Wing that was involving the improvement of what we call the Little River Bulkhead, which is very south, but still within the city limits of Red Wing and close to one of our major manufacturers, USG. USG annually converts a wool-like material, about 250,000 tons, and then it's transported to Cloquet, Minnesota, and made into ceiling panels. And by shifting the transportation of this raw material and then the processed material as well from about 5 miles from a northern port in Red Wing to a southern port in Red Wing, it greatly reduced the number of trucks and other vehicles that were necessary to haul the matter to this northern port. And so this is just an example of several projects that have been funded by the Port Development Assistance Program. And I believe a question was asked about the funding, and there has been funding in place since 1996, and that totals about $27 million. And as ports, we have project lists, and we've compiled a priority project list of about $12 million, and then a future project list of $31 million. And like many transportation systems, our infrastructure in some cases dates back to developments that occurred in the 40s and the 50s and is really beyond its useful life. So in order to maintain our viability as ports, we always need financial resources to maintain and improve docks, wall pilings, numerous land-based improvements involving warehouses, and road and rail accessibility. And as Mr. Fino indicated, it's all about sort of intermodal connectivity, so it's not just about waterway transport, but then connecting the rails and the trucks and other modes of transportation to really create this efficient and seamless transportation system for both exports and imports. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Questions, members? Ms. Lauder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to do half the good job Randy did in truncating his comments. You do have a one-page map. And, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention that there is the St. Paul Harbor, and there are four terminal areas that are noted there. And just to orient you, where it says barge terminal number 2, directly north of there is St. Paul's downtown. The yellow hash marks are actually all of our fleeting areas, and we do lease those out. And URS on the map is our harbor operator, known as Upper River Services Corporation. We have a long-term land lease and fleeting lease as well to them. Mr. Chair, first of all, a huge note of thanks to everyone in the past who has voted for these funds. They're very critical, as Randy was saying, and we deeply appreciate that. The other thing is, Mr. Chair, as some of you may be aware, the Twin Cities Public Television Group has just issued a really nice set of videos of all of the systems, air and truck and air highway and barge traffic, shipping ports, and I will send that to every member, so you'll have that. The port section is about 25 minutes long. It's really interesting, so I thought that might be fun for you to see. Mr. Chair, I just will skip over a few things. You know, there are a lot of commodities, particularly agricultural products and fertilizer and cement, road salt, and all that that comes in and out of the St. Paul Harbor. About half of our shippers ship in the global marketplace, and a little bit more on that in a second. Wanted to just talk about equivalent units. One barge that you've probably all seen on the river, that is the equivalent of 15 jumbo hopper cars on rail, and that's also the equivalent of about 70 semi-trailers as far as load capacity. If you take 15 of those barges, which is the maximum you can function with a towboat, that's called a tow, and these 15 barges remove over 1,000 semi-trailers in terms of the equivalency there, remove them from the roads, if you were to think about it that way. Lastly, Mr. Chair, on some of these geeky numbers, fuel efficiency is quite amazing as well. If you take 1 ton of product and then you take 1 gallon of diesel fuel, a barge can move that product 576 miles. The equivalent rail car can move that 413 miles, and a tractor trailer can move it 155 miles. So I thought it would be interesting just to give you kind of a relative read on that. Winona is not here. I think I owe them just a little shout out here. And they have used funds as well as the three other ports here. Again, thank you for that. They've removed a sunken barge, which was disrupting the movement of traffic to and from their commercial dock. They've replaced barge mooring facilities and constructed a new mooring cell and rehabilitated their existing commercial dock wall. So among other things, those are some of the things they've done. In our St. Paul Harbor, as Randy mentioned in his harbor, the infrastructure, there's no way to say it. It's just terribly aged. Most of our dock walls, which if you look at an equivalent, it's kind of like the highways in the highway sort of realm. These dock walls are the public ways that commerce happens. And most of our dock walls were built during the WPA days, well beyond their 50-year asset life. Even our newer dock walls, and we have had one in particular that has suffered a huge failure, just a huge sinkhole, those were built in the 60s. So doing the math, those two are greater than the 50-year asset life. With these funds, about 5 years ago, we did develop one new dock wall, about a 1,300 lineal foot dock wall where one had never been, and it helped the environment because the sloughing off into the water of the soil was stopped, as well as it's a beautiful new area. We have one company actually from Stewartville that's going to come in, establish themselves in our harbor for the first time, sell organic product, and build about a 68,000 square foot facility, and there's a little more room there too to grow. Mr. Chair, in wrapping up here, the closing of the Minneapolis port is huge to us because we've had a lot of folks coming to us saying, can you take some of our businesses? And speaking of our businesses, we have about 30 businesses. As I said, about half of them are in the global economy, and those equal or provide about 775 jobs. So what it means is a challenge and an opportunity. We can take some of those depending on what area they need, what dock wall space they need, and so forth. We do need even more funds to put in additional infrastructure in our harbor to accommodate some of the Minneapolis parts there. And then certainly it'll provide increased volume, and that's really imperative for us to move forward on that. And I think I'll end there, Mr. Chair, and turn it over to the Seaway Port Authority of Duluth. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Lauder. DeLuca.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you very much for having us here today to tell the story of the ports, and in particular for me, for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, and thank you, Senator Reinert, for the invitation as well. How much time do we have? Should I cut this way back?
Well, we're over time, so.
Over time, okay.
Our attention is growing thin, but take as much time as you like.
I see the phone's coming up, Mr. Chair. All right. Well, let's see, how do I shorten this up? The Duluth Seaway Port Authority owns and manages multiple industrial properties. We are an economic development agency. We're a state economic development agency. We maintain this industrial property and the port infrastructure on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Most notably, we operate and maintain the Kluwer Public Marine Terminal, and I think I gave you a packet. I'm not going to spend time referring to those maps. I think only Senator Westrum got the Kluwer Terminal map. The Kluwer Terminal is the only general cargo facility in the state and the only public marine terminal where small to mid-sized businesses can access international shipping channels to export their goods. We also represent the interests of 20 private bulk cargo terminals in the Port of Duluth Superior. So some of those are on the Wisconsin side. The Port of Duluth Superior is, as Patrick didn't mention this, we're the largest port on the Great Lakes in terms of tonnage and the 19th largest port in the U.S. in terms of tonnage. Patrick hit on tons of cargo, but we have 38 million short tons of cargo because we have to account for the entire port, which again includes that Wisconsin section. But we also are served by 4 Class I railroads, which is very rare. Most ports are served by 1 or 2, and we're fully intermodal, which means that millions of additional tons of cargo move through the port, which never touch a ship. They just go by road and rail. Let's see, we'll shorten this up, moving along. It's only a 2-week trip.
This is the largest port on the Great Lakes?
It is, by tonnage.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yep. It's only a 2-week trip from the Kluwer Terminal to cities in Europe and then beyond. We really are the only direct connection via water to Europe, Middle East, Mediterranean, and North Africa. So we give worldwide exposure to Minnesota's mining, manufacturing, agricultural, and energy sectors. And Patrick touched on the type of cargo we handle. But for over a century, we've been one of the largest drivers of economic activity in northern Minnesota. We support over 11,500 jobs that generate $1.5 billion in business revenue to bolster the state's economy. In addition, and as part of that, businesses operating on our industrial properties that we lease, they employ directly more than 1,100 people and give them living wage jobs. I think it's really important to understand how we operate. We only have a very modest tax levy from the city of Duluth. It amounts to only about $900,000 a year, and we receive some grant funds. They're critical, but the majority of our operational budget is self-generated from revenue produced from our cargo handling and our property leasing activities. At the same time, as both Randy and Lori have mentioned, we have millions and millions of dollars worth of public infrastructure to maintain. Lori mentioned dock walls. It costs $3,000 per lineal foot to build a dock wall, and we maintain nearly 9,000 lineal feet of dock wall in the Port of Duluth. We also maintain over 700,000 square feet of building space. Half of that is leased to private employers, and half is available for cargo handling and warehousing. Really, in a way, we maintain a micro-city of infrastructure in the Kluwer Public Terminal. We manage these assets really carefully. We generate roughly $2 million in lease revenues and $1.5 in cargo handling revenues annually. And yet those infrastructure costs are out there. So that's where the State Port Development Assistant Grant Program is really important to us. It's ably administered by MnDOT. It helps us round out our infrastructure investments and provides the required match for the federal grants that we increasingly need to pursue to complete our infrastructure projects. And I want to give you an example of how that works in Duluth. We're rebuilding a dock called Dock C&D. It's adjacent to the Kluwer Public Terminal. It's about 28 acres in size, but it was vacant for 20 years, actually over 20 years. And so it generated no tax. It generated no job opportunities. It didn't have rail or road connections, so not very functional. And the dock wall was completely dilapidated. Channel slip was inadequate. It needed dredging to accommodate ships that were fully laden. So the first phase of redevelopment Patrick referenced is a $16 to $17 million project. We have a Tiger grant to help us with that. That project will put the – after that project is completed, the first phase will be a fully operable terminal, fully operable dock, and will expand. Essentially, will expand the Kluwer public terminal capacity. It's also going to be a shovel-ready development site where new businesses can build, where businesses can build and invest in Minnesota and create jobs. But we use only $2.33 million in Minnesota Port Development Assistance Grant funds, and that leveraged that $10 million U.S. DOT Tiger Grant and also $3.75 million of our own money. To us, it's hugely valuable. We use it to leverage additional funds. Note that it was only funded with $2 million last year, and we used $2.33 million of those funds. We had to kind of compile them over a couple of years of funding. So we're not asking for a donation. This really become an investment in the state's port infrastructure. And we feel that we can use these dollars to leverage private and public funds. We can demonstrate that. Economic activity, jobs, it's a good return for the taxpayers of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. That's my quick and dirty.
Thank you. We were curious to hear more about the little gremlins that are eating the walls, the sheet piling. Yeah.
You really want to hear all about tubercles we have been working, actually, the University of Minnesota Duluth and Minnesota Sea Grant have been working on that. They think they've identified the mechanism. There's high naturally occurring copper levels in the waters in the harbor and in the lake. It's also true up at Silver Bay. Anyway, that creates this whole microenvironment for a particular type of microbe that creates corrosion anaerobically, and then it gets scraped off in the winter. And anyway, we have new coatings that we think are working. We're testing them right now. It seems to be successful.
I understand from conversations with Senator Reinert and others that it's a paradox of the water becoming cleaner has allowed these creatures to thrive.
I have heard that and I don't know the details on that. Maybe Senator Reinert would like to speak to that in some greater detail.
Please do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, and if we wanted to do more on it, there was great research done by our land grant university into why that is. But when the port was when the water was less clean in the port, these organisms couldn't thrive. And now that the water, we've done a great job of cleaning up the water, it's now sort of the right environment for these bacteria to be around. And as Deb mentioned, they function anaerobically, so they adhere themselves to the metal, and then part of their life cycle is consuming other components of the metal. It's like their food source. So it will be interesting to see if these coatings do the trick. And then, as Deb mentioned, the movement of the ice in the winter in the harbor. And as most people know, the lake rarely freezes over, but the harbor routinely freezes over. And then, of course, we break ice. So the movement of that ice against sort of this crust on the sheathing is what's wearing away the pilings.
Seattle struggles with a similar problem, but that's salt water, I think. So it's a different situation.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, just thank you very much. A couple of questions. Just trying to understand the landscape a little bit. In terms of ownership, for instance, the city of Duluth or Winona or St. Paul, do they actually own the ports? You know, when we come down over the hill in Duluth and see all that stuff, if you will, who owns that?
Mr. Chair and Senator, no, the city owns none of that. The Duluth Seaway Port Authority owns only the Kluwer Public Terminal, the little tiny 1950s Mad Men era office that we inhabit, and the Dock C&D. And then the rest of that is privately owned terminals. Those are all bulk terminals, and bulk is anything you can pour from a chute, so grain, salt, limestone, taconite. And as I said, we're the only, I didn't go into detail, but the Kluwer terminal, which you see down there, is the only break bulk facility, which means we handle super sacks, big, you know, individual pieces, things you can lift with a crane or super sacks. So the really large wind turbine equipment comes through our port, both directions, interestingly enough. Really large energy generating equipment, In fact, it's, some of it's so large we need to wait for the ground to freeze to be able to ship it on to move it on rail. So does that help at all? None of it's city owned.
Yeah, I think it does.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Senjum, in St. Paul, we own most of the land, probably 98% of the land. We lease that to our companies. We own several buildings, although not all of them. And that's been a longstanding policy since probably the 1950s.
And Mr. Chair, just very quickly in Red Wing, the primary ownership of the commercial shipping activity is largely privately held. However, we have leases with these companies because they occupy adjacent lands that are owned by the City of Red Wing and the Port Authority. So for truck fleeting purposes and for staging, for example, we have leases with those privately held companies to enable them to be more efficient with the transport of commodities and manufactured goods. And as I said in my testimony, we do maintain actually two docks, two bulkheads, and we have a bulkhead operator that then drives business to those. But that's all contracted with him, much like St. Paul has.
Senator.
And thank you. And just one more, just it doesn't have to be lengthy, but as we talk about ports and as we even visit them on Capital Investment Committee tours, and I think we've been to all of these, but I'm just thinking about two harbors. Is that seems like an outlier. We've never stopped there. We never seem to talk about it. Are they part of the Duluth Port Authority, or are they just out there sort of as independent?
Ms. DeLuca.
No, they're not part of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. They are. It's a very small port. I don't actually know what ships out of that terminal. Do you know? It's
not my district, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, it looks pretty big when a person from southern Minnesota drives up and sees those.
It is. Yeah.
Mr. Fino, do you know?
Mr. Chair, I think they move mostly taconite out of there as well.
It's all private.
But that is
it's
an entirely private
yeah.
terminal, yes.
All right. Thank you.
But they're... Mr. Chair, they're apparently able to get along without our support in some fashion.
But is that CN? Is that the one that CN serviced?
Cliffs, I think.
You know, let me get you some more information.
That's fine. It's just a curiosity thing.
It's not at all the same scale of. Sorry,
Mr.
Chair.
When you're from southern Minnesota, you see two harbors. It looks pretty major, but maybe it's not.
Some big ships. I've been down to the water. Some big ships sitting out there, but it's nothing like Duluth Superior.
Of course not.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment. I so enjoy your Great Lakes graphic here about all the lakes, but especially how they have Canada and all the different states and the ports on it. Just a really effective, just one pager that for me has just been really, really fun and a very interesting presentation. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I had a quick question for Mr. Fino. So when we, on the happenstance, put a couple million bucks into the ports fund and you do a request for proposals, what is typically the unmet need or what has been the unmet need lately?
Mr. Chair, I think the unmet need that the ports have identified is about $30, $31 million. And most sessions they put together a package of near-term needs that is about $10 to $12 million. And the grant fund that we get go to projects that are on that list.
Great. Thanks. And a nice photograph of you in the magazine, by the way.
Oh. Not intentional.
Senator Reiner.
Just a couple closing comments, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, if we're wrapping up. One is I just want to say again, largest port on the Great Lakes and 19th largest by tonnage in the country. So our Duluth Seaway Port is a major state asset, not just a Duluth one. And secondly, to any member of the committee, the Great Lakes Legislative Caucus is open to any legislator in Minnesota as a Great Lakes state. I think those of us who live on the lake know these issues, these shipping and commerce issues and the environmental ones, so it's actually most helpful for members that don't live on the lakes to be involved with that. So we'd welcome participation from any member of this committee.
Great. Thank you. The only other thought that occurs to me, is just to have more discussion around environmental issues as it relates to the ports. We talked about the AIS and dredging and that sort of thing. The other thing I know that the big, big ports on the ocean struggle with, especially like Long Beach, Los Angeles, is the carbon footprint of port operations. So
but we can talk about that another time, maybe some work for the next ports plan. Anything further, members? Members will be meeting on Wednesday. We'll have another overview. We might run a couple of bills. We're not quite sure yet, but we have a couple more overviews, and we're going to get to some member requests as well, member overview requests. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.